Hello everybody, and welcome to another episode of Investories Podcast. For those of you who started subscribing to us recently, welcome aboard. Investories is a podcast produced by the Investors Club organization. My name is Alexander, and today in studio I have my co-host with me, our international member, Omar. Hi, Omar.
Hello, everyone.
Today, our very honored guest is Mr. Andy Gray, partner at Tilia Impact Ventures. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Hey, I'm very well. Thank you. Good afternoon.
It's great to have you on board, Andy. In today's episode, we will focus on impact investment in venture capital world. Andy, could you share a little bit more about your background and how you become involved in impact investing and why you even choose VC industry in the first place?
Yeah, so I'm from New Zealand originally, as you can probably hear in my accent. And it's a funny story. I mean, every podcast that you ever listen to from a VC has the same cringeworthy, I didn't expect to end up in VC. So I didn't expect to end up in VC. I started off doing management consulting, strategy consulting in New Zealand. And, you know, when you do strategy consulting, it follows cyclical patterns. And I was in the bust pattern of the economy. So we were doing a lot of job cutting. And to be honest, it wasn't exactly the work that I wanted to be doing. You become very, very good at being desensitized and being efficient. And I started to think more that the growth side might be more interesting for me. So I was quite happy when I had the opportunity to move over to Prague with my wife, who's Czech, to get into the growth side and actually to get in the innovative side. So I moved into startups. I worked for a small voting startup that we grew internationally and grew to like quite a nice size. Took a break, did an MBA in Cambridge, and that changed my mind a bit about what I wanted to be doing and how I could apply my skills. I think why VC is I realized from working in a startup that you can only really apply your time once to something. So I was putting all my life and soul into one startup. And if it doesn't turn out the way you think, then you feel like you've maybe, you know, you haven't leveraged your time as much as possible. The thing about VC that's attractive is you can leverage your money by investing in a lot of startups at the same time. And therefore you can actually put yourself and your experience across a lot of these startups. So prior to working in VC, I was helping different startups to fundraise on a kind of M&A consultancy basis. And then it was sort of a natural progression into VC. And why impact? So I just think that of all the VC fields that you could be in now, this is the most interesting and the most meaningful. And if VC is quite a long game. You know, it's 10-year funds, 5-year investment cycles. If I think about what I'm going to achieve in the next 10 years, I think it would rather be to make some positive change and really make some kind of systemic difference in the way people do things than to back B2B SaaS nonstop. I also think that the way that the markets are trending now is such that there's the returns, the same scale of returns is in the kind of stuff that we're investing in as a regular VC. So it's not even a concessionary decision. So yeah, great prospects, fantastic market to be in. And yeah, that's why impact investing.
Love this background and love how your story, how you end up in a VC and with the impact investments. And now I want to talk more about Tilia Impact Ventures. What is your focus and mission and how does it differ from other venture capital funds?
Yeah, so we started off, we're on our second fund now. We started off our pilot baby fund about 2.5-3 years ago, and I wasn't a part of that. This was pre-me days, and also the focus was a little bit different. So it was initially started out as a way of showing that impact deals exist, that impact investing is a kind of viable alternative for deploying capital in the CEE region, and that my partners could actually build the deal flow and deploy the capital. And I think they proved that quite successfully. And if anything, the market exploded faster than we thought that it would. And suddenly we felt like, oh, we don't have enough capital and we need to increase our fund size. So we then set out, and this is where I joined in, we set out to raise our second fund. So our second fund is an order of magnitude bigger than the first fund. So we're targeting $32 million, just about to have our first close now. So woohoo.
Okay.
it was a longer process and the market is quite difficult for fundraising now. So we're proud that we've closed. And our strategy is basically to do So we're a generalist within impact investing. It means that half of our fund is planet and half of our fund is people. Planet is your traditional climate investing, and people is mostly capital efficient digital healthcare, and then ed tech. These are tougher markets because, you know, in the Czech Republic and also across the whole CEE region, it's kind of a fragmented market and it's a little bit more difficult to invest in. Our climate is just exploding here. So it's really interesting to be in that space and to see the kind of technical prowess of the Czech Republic and the CEE region. Our new fund will be covering the whole region. So previously we were Czech focused and we just towards the end of our fund started to open up a little bit more regionally. And in our next fund, we are regionally focused. We're investing at seed stage. So average ticket size for us is between 300K and let's say about 1.2 million. Sorry, that's the window. And then the average would be about 750K for a first ticket. And that means that the rounds that we're investing in are around 1 million euro rounds. And seed stage, I guess your listeners know what seed stage is, but you need a bit of traction.
Yes.
You need to have a product that's starting to feel out some product market fit. We love to hear from a few customers that they absolutely love the product. And we need to see quite a viable path for you to scaling, especially in this region, to scaling beyond the country that you have started out in.
Okay, so out of curiosity, will you walk us how a typical day would look like until the VC?
Yeah.
Your typical day.
Yep. So I'm just thinking, I didn't maybe answer a previous question and I can tie those together, which is how does what we do differ from traditional VC? I don't think it does differ from traditional. Like, it's a different strategy, but the work that we do overlaps almost identically. So, you know, my job comprises of raising awareness of the fund. So people need to know who we are, how we can support them, why they would want to work with us. Then we need to actually get out and meet founders. So, you know, there's no point in us sitting back and waiting for emails to come in. We need to be out in the market, getting to know founders, keeping our ear to the ground, getting to know our partners, both, you know, upstream partners. So these are people who are doing angel investments, accelerators, but also downstream partners. So these are people who are investing and supporting the companies that we invest in, because that helps us to add value to the companies that we work with, if we're able to open doors for them and kind of support them on their journey. That segues nicely to the next thing we do, which is that we support our portfolio companies. So all the companies that we invest in, depending on whether we are the lead or whether we can be useful, we're generally pretty hands-on. So if we can be useful, we'll get stuck in and we'll help you with whatever we can. So that's everything from being more impact-focused stuff, like how do I communicate the change that I'm making? How do I measure it? But also general VC stuff, hiring, fundraising, you know, finding product market fit and creating your plan to go to market, de-risking yourself, spending your money wisely. We support with all of this as a regular VC would. And then the final part of my job is executing deals. So we run a pipeline, you know, we meet a founder, we start to date, we go on a few dates, we decide we like each other, and then very quickly we get married for the next 5 years. And that deal execution process can be quite intense. And, you know, it comes in waves. So quite often we are almost all the time nonstop crushing a deal, but we share that throughout our team to kind of share the workload.
Nice. And I would love to hear more about how does Telia VC describe impact and what criteria do you use to evaluate if this startup is within your impact investment field?
Yeah, so we look at the change that the founder is trying to make. So our thesis is that we want to make systemic change in the world, and we look for founders that are really trying to make the change. You know, you don't know how the company will turn out. You don't know how their journey will go or who will be the kind of customer that loves the product. So we really start with the founder and start with the problem they're trying to solve. Like, what is the systemic problem and what is your solution that can really make systemic change? And then we focus on either how wide is that change? So how many people can you touch with this solution? And how many problems can you solve, or how profound is that change? So some things are relatively superficial but can help really a lot of people. And then other things are extremely profound but maybe have a more concentrated or niche market. And we're open for both of those. So we rather have to balance the how wide and how deep and then make a view on, is this really a big change maker? And there's a lot of things that don't necessarily make change but might appear to. So we really...
Such as?
Yeah. A lot of it's about substitution. So you look at the status quo, like what's the way that people go about trying to resolve this problem now? What's the solution that you're presenting? And does that really equate to some kind of systemic difference in the way that you're going about solving the problem? I'll take one example. There's a lot of companies are doing lab cultured meat at the moment, and we've been very fortunate to have talked to a lot of these companies, and it's quite interesting that the change differs greatly depending on the product they're making and the substitution effect of that. So if you're targeting a very low end of the market where you're maybe using you're targeting offcuts of meat that are otherwise waste, then you could question what would happen to that meat anyway. You know, it's waste anyway. So the substitution effect, you could say, is relatively neutral. And therefore, you're not really making systemic change if you're subbing out offcuts and waste of meat for lab-cultured meat. Whereas beef is an obvious one. You know, beef, people, it's the highest-priced human consumption product. People pay extreme amounts for it. And it has an incredibly negative, gas emission, greenhouse gas emissions, water, carbon footprint, land use. And so, you substitute that out and you're making really meaningful change. So the product might be the same. It's lab cultured meat, but the application of it has a different substitution effect, and therefore the change is very different. Maybe a second example there is we often see companies that don't really have a clear link between their behavior and the outcome they're trying to make. So you might say, we're an HR tool that makes people happy. So companies use us and they get some benefits, and the benefits make people happy. And therefore, every dollar that we get is an extra unit of happiness in the world. And when we peel back the layers, it's very hard to isolate the units of happiness that has been generated as a result of this activity. And we tend to avoid companies where we can't make a clear link between the thing that they do and the change that they're trying to make, which is, the happiness of a person. I mean, happiness is very hard to measure, but that's a generic example. And we see this a lot in almost every field. So there has to be a very clear causal link between your activity and the change you're making. And that's really how we evaluate it. Like, how deep, how wide, and is there a causal link in what you're doing? And then we just look for founder fit. Like I said, we don't know where the companies are going to go. So it's like a relationship. You don't know how it's going to be at the next stage of your relationship, but you know that you're kind of philosophically aligned. So we look for philosophical alignment with our founders, and that's the most important thing at our stage of investing.
So when coming to investing, a lot of people might confuse it with the ESG and SDG. So what do you think are the differences between ESG and impact investing?
Yeah, cool. Good question. There's a lot of three-letter acronyms being thrown around in our space, and it's not helping. For me, so SDG, the Sustainable Development Goals, this is a framework that the UN have come up with to talk about a lot of the problems that exist and to create a framework for making change towards a better future, 2030 and 2050. That's a super cool way for us to structure how we think, because we can look at investments and say, which problem area is it targeting? And it creates a common language, a common framework that we can talk with other investors and talk with founders. That's super helpful for us. It's a little bit aside of what I would say, impact investing and ESG. These are the two concepts to clarify. So ESG is how you go about doing your business. So you can be any company. You can make cups or cars or drill oil or whatever. And ESG is the process of looking through every part of your business and saying, are we doing it in a responsible, sustainable way, regardless of what you do? So it's really how you do it. Whereas what we are doing in impact investing is we're looking at what you do. Like, if you make cars or cups, it's not really interesting for us. What is interesting for us is exactly what you are doing. And then the ESG element for us is hygiene. So we expect our companies to be ESG responsible in their environmental, social, and governance practices. And it tends to be that the kind of founders that we work with, the ones that really want to make big changes to the world, they just see ESG as common practice. So ESG is like a way of cleaning up and calling out maybe less intrinsically motivated people. And so for us, ESG is not as important. It really, what matters for us is more what you do than exactly how you do it. But it is important. It is important for all companies to kind of comply with good ESG practices. And there are some fantastic frameworks and tools that you can use as a startup and also as a VC, so that you can help your startups to understand, like, what's good practice? How do you clean things up? How do you give everybody a fair shot? How do you do it sustainably? But every VC should be doing that, not just impact investors. We look at the what you're doing, and everybody should be looking at the how you're doing it. Maybe a shout out for one of the tools that I really love is,
yeah,
there's a group of not just UK investors, but it's generally driven by UK investors that have got together and formed this collaboration called Venture ESG. And they've started to push a lot of templates and policies and tools, and it's a really easy one-stop shop for VCs. You don't have to be an impact investor or, you know, a climate fund or whatever. Just, I think all VCs should stop and check it out. It'll give you the tools that you can arm your founders with in a really light touch way. Because none of us want to drown our founders in, like, guilt and compliance. Like, oh, you're not measuring this and you're not complying with this. So it's recognizing that your most important thing as a founder is to keep the lights on, keep your business running and do the thing, build a great product, get it out quickly. But at the same time, here are some really light touch ways that you can get everybody to speak the same language, think the same things, and kind of be philosophically aligned to be sustainable. And that's really interesting.
That's nice, because in my opinion, this should be exactly coming from within of the founder. Like, you believe in these things and you already live by it. So it's nothing new for you. You don't need to adjust your rules, like you said, overly complicated compliance, you know, like in some big bureaucratic complex, you know, corporates or something. But it's like natural way of doing, and you just amplify it. So
exactly.
Totally agree. And what I'm interested in, we already touched a little bit this, but okay, you have invested in some of the companies. We can touch what are the companies later, but how do you measure impact created after your investment within those companies, and how do you measure after your investment is already running? What impact was created after it? Did the company multiply it, or did it stay the same? What's the idea behind this, and what's your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great topical question, because it's something that we have found our own way to,
okay,
using a few kind of recommended frameworks and generally accepted practices within impact investing. But it's something which is becoming like the topic for funds that are promoting themselves as creating positive change. What I mean by that, so we use a framework from the Impact Management Project, IMP. We've kind of blended it and freestyled it a little bit to make our own framework. Basically, we look at the change, we look at the activities that you do, and we say, what are the outcomes that you're trying to achieve, the societal outcomes, the think big stuff? Then can we measure that? And often the answer is no. You know, if you're trying to measure happiness or you're trying to measure some really think big stuff. So it's more like, can we create a proven causal link between your activities and the outcomes that you're trying to achieve? And then we say, well, we can definitely measure the activities, and we can continue maybe once every so often to baseline and say, are we really making the change that we thought we were? And we set targets against that. So every company that we invest in, we sit down with them and we go through this kind of theory of change, which is the let's say the supply chain of change through the company, from the inputs, the activities, the outputs, the outcomes. And we set targets against this. And I always say that, like, the only thing we know when we meet a VC is that their business plan is wrong, and that the impact KPIs are probably overly ambitious. So we do need to keep our eye on making sure that we continually, like, assess this with teams, maybe once a year or whatever. And then we hold ourselves to account with that. And this is where it's becoming a really hot topic. So we have elected in our second fund to tie our carry, so that's our partner remuneration performance bonus, to the change that our fund delivers. So we have a mechanism where we set a couple of KPIs, let's say, per company, and we set a target against those. And then, and usually it's closely linked to the business plan. So it's not rocket science that if the company does well, generally the KPIs do well. And if there's a big disconnect between them, maybe there's something wrong in the way that we've set it up. So we have an independent body within our governance of the fund that will verify and if needed, will change these KPIs from time to time to make sure they're achievable and valid. And then at the end, we basically weight our portfolio by how much money we've put into each of these companies. We roll that value up of, you know, did we achieve each of these KPIs? If yes, then it's a, if 100%, then it's a one. You roll that up and you get basically a number between zero and, let's say, one, but it can be more than one if you over-deliver. And we as a fund need to achieve a certain amount. I think for us it's 60% of the change that we thought that we would make in order to be eligible to get the carry. So that's us putting our money where our mouths are. And that's been quite a, not controversial, but like hotly debated topic. And it's a really interesting one because I'm not concerned about it because I know that the companies that we invest in are going to do change anyway. And if they don't do change, they're not making any money because their activity generates the change. So there will only be carry for us if there is positive impact and positive outcomes. I highly doubt that we'd get in the situation where we have a company that does well financially and hasn't really made any change. But if that were the case, then theoretically there would be a situation where we wouldn't be eligible for our carry and we would donate that. So that's really us putting our money where our mouth is there. And this attracts LPs, that they can see that we've put more skin in the game to be highly aligned to actually choose founders that are not like, you know, not greenwashing. They're really trying to do some kind of positive impact that can be measured and can be reported. And we attract capital because of that.
I want to touch the thing you mentioned because there is a lot of greenwashing going on with this, I would say, not hype, but a trend within this impact ESG. And a lot of people, even the founders, are trying to just catch the wave and just selling the green future, but actually not doing it. What are your thoughts on this? And what, for example, examples could you point out that you recently encountered on this?
Yeah, so the differentiation is just getting so much more refined now that I think that party of jumping on the wave is over and it is just about to finish this year. So there's a regulation coming in called SFDR, the Sustainable Financial Disclosures Regulation. It requires that all funds that are deploying capital, so whether you're a regular VC or you're an impact VC, that they report on the ESG and the outcomes of their portfolio companies. So something that we were previously doing voluntarily is actually becoming mandatory. And then you have to choose as a fund which of their subsections you fall under for the SFDR disclosure. You can declare, I don't really do that. That's not for me. And then you become what's called an Article 6 fund. And that has very, very low reporting requirements. But also you become labeled as an Article 6 fund. So it's clear that you're not really in it for the impact. So this washing element has kind of gone from that. And vice versa, you can be then Article 8, which is like we're trying, but we're not really measuring everything. And then Article 9 is we're really measuring and reporting the full like effects, positive and negative, of our companies that we invest in. And I don't even think what we're doing will be called impact investing in about a year. I believe they'll just be called Article 9 funds. So if you hear this this Article 9 and wonder what it is, that's what it is. Because it's finally a way for funds like us who keep saying, we're different, you know, we have our money where our mouth is and we only invest in real founders that are generating real difference. This has become regulated. So funds who are Article 9 can no longer afford to invest in companies which are greenwashing. So there kind of becomes a natural, segregation between you have purely impact-driven founders that are measurable and can be invested in by Article 9 funds. You have Article 9 funds which will only attract capital from purpose-driven LPs, purpose-driven investors. And this idea of funds holding themselves out as being green and attracting green capital is starting to go down because they won't want to be Article 9 because of the extra reporting and compliance regulations. And likewise, like the founders won't attract capital from Article 9 funds if they're not in it.
Back to what you have said earlier, you are a bit picky with the companies you put your funds on. Would you describe like a few of the criteria you have when it's coming to pick a company? Like what are positive criteria you are looking for, negative? And if you could give us an example of a company that...
Sure. So it's not about being picky. Like all good VCs are thesis driven, and you start to specialize so that the founders know what you can help them with, and so that you attract the right kind of founders that you want to invest in. So us supporting people and planet is a thesis, and that attracts founders to us. So it's not about being picky. It's just that it's not really interesting for us to do pure B2B SaaS or, you know, 15-minute deliveries, these kind of things. We have a thesis and we want to stick to that. And we become quite good at investing within our thesis because we do it again and again. And founders know what to expect when they work with us because we hold ourselves out as doing that. So our first screening criteria is impact. But it's a kind of negative screening. It's like, is this really an impactful project or not? Or could this have the potential to be impactful? If not, we will quite often reject it, even if the company might be quite financially interesting. We will always reject it at that stage. And then we look at the business just as a investment. And we say, you know, is it financially and commercially interesting? Can we help this company to really scale, to do whatever they do on a global scale? So we, in that sense, we apply the same criteria as regular VCs once they've gone through their impact screening. Maybe one thing that's a little bit different is often impact companies take a little bit longer to blossom. They can have a slightly longer J curve than your regular like B2B SaaS. And it means that often they start their lives getting grant funding or getting funded by, they might have slightly longer like angel investment cycles. So we have to be aware of that. And it means that sometimes the market size is a little bit smaller than it is for regular VCs. But it's become a kind of contrarian view that if you talk to any VC, they're like, you know, oh, it's the power law. And okay, it is the power law. Like, I shouldn't say it in their voice. It is the power law. The majority of our returns as a fund will come from very, very few of our investments, one or two of our investments. And we are no different to that. But there's a distribution, a variance within your portfolio, and you can kind of get caught up in the floor of averages of looking at the fund's overall return, its TVPI, and saying like, oh yeah, so on average, a company is returning this. Whereas most VCs are putting together portfolios where they have far more zeros and then a few absolute, absolute smashed out of the park. But when you get too many VCs doing that and they all apply the same criteria, you get overcrowding in the hot investments, which gives any given VC less of a chance, unless you're the top VCs, of actually accessing those deals and closing those deals. But it also gives an advantage to people who can think a little bit differently to that. So for us, we expect that our portfolio variance will be a little bit less wide than this huge, you know, one out of the park and the others at zero. So we're investing in companies, they call them zebras. You know, it's like they might not have the potential to return the fund. Ideally, they do, and that would be fantastic. But we're also open to investing, I think, into more companies that have, you know, 20x or 15x return potentials, as long as we can see that this is slightly less risky than some of the lottery tickets that a lot of other VCs are going for. But the thing that really de-risks it for us is if we're not in the crowd chasing the one thing that's being crowded out by all VCs, then you actually just have a lot better opportunity to find fantastic founders that everybody else has overlooked and get into deals that everybody else is ignoring. So it's a little bit of a contrarian view for our portfolio composition. And I think in this region, where I really believe there's more capital than good deals, doing a slightly contrarian strategy, I think, is a winning strategy, but we will see that over the next 5 years.
Now, let's touch the founder side and management. What qualities you especially are you looking in the founders and in their management team? And what criteria are you considering when you evaluate them? You already mentioned that founders are really important for you. So let's touch this more.
Yeah, I think you have to think about the environment in which founders operate. So they're operating in extreme uncertainty. I mean, if they're really doing something innovative that no one has done before, then half the intelligent people in any room would say that it's nonsense, it's impossible, for great reasons. And half the people won't. And so you think about like what kind of person, despite being told by half the people that they talk to that it's a bad idea, can continue on. And what kind of person in such an uncertain environment where you don't know whether your company will, you hope it'll still exist next year, but you don't know that. And you have to hire and lead a team through that. And you're, if it's, again, if it's innovation, you're doing this for the first time. You might have had a company before, you might have gone through the process with another startup, but whatever you're doing right now, you're doing it for the first time generally. And you have to convince your team that they should give some of the best years of their life to you. I think that's a much harder thing than getting money from investors, is actually to like hire the best people and keep them through this valley of despair. It takes a certain kind of personality. And this personality is not necessarily the easiest person to get along with. So we always say, oh, we want someone coachable. And I do want someone coachable because I want them to listen when I share some of the mistakes that I've made or that we've seen through, that we've seen vicariously. But at the same time, we can't have someone who asks, what should I do next? What should I do next? How should I? Because they really are facing, when I was in my startup, we're facing every day almost an existential decision to go left or right. And you know that potentially if you choose right, it's the wrong path, you die. And you have to have someone who's consistently able to intuitively make good decisions every single day. That can't be the VC. That has to be the founder. So you look for people who have enough tenacity and sometimes delusional self-confidence to pull this off. Because to stand up when your company has like a 3-month runway and to stand up and tell your team that it's going to be good, like I'm going to raise the next round and this is just starting to take off, it takes a lot of confidence and true belief in what you're doing. So we look for the founders that back themselves first and foremost. That's probably the most important thing. And then you need a problem area that the founder understands. Like founder naivety is probably how half of the companies that I've seen invested in die, because the founder spends your money getting to know the market and understanding things that are already known knowns, but they're just unknown to them. So like why something wouldn't work I would want to see that the founder who comes to us really understands like what's the status quo of their market, but what's the problem with that? And then how are you really doing it differently? And why do you have an edge on that? Or how could you have an edge on that? So for example, if it's like a hotly competitive market, a lot of hotly competitive markets, the secret is in the distribution, not in the product. Like you can make a better hamburger than McDonald's, but you're not going to be on every street corner and able to distribute like McDonald's or Coca-Cola. If the founder doesn't understand that it's a distribution problem and they just say, oh, my product's so much better than someone else's. Cool. That's fantastic. You need a great product. But you've got no edge if you can't distribute it in a way to get through the crowded market. So yeah, we look for intelligent founders that really get the nature of their own market and can convey that to us and then can sell us on the idea that they have a kind of path or a theory to get through the challenge that they're facing in their market.
Amazing. I want to touch because you mentioned that when you were in your startup, you are facing existential crisis almost every day. Could you maybe, with all of this, let's say technical stuff, just, little bit divert from the course and just highlight maybe some of the lessons learned from this area, this period of time when you were in startup, maybe one, like the biggest lesson that you learned.
Yeah, for us, it was don't overhire. Like, don't grow your team too quickly. There are basically two philosophies for hiring. One is like, I need to sell data, so I'm going to hire a data team and they'll figure it out. They'll figure out my data product and then data will be a core part of our revenue offering. That is a bad idea. So you need generalists in your really small core team, your early team, who can basically like bring things to the point of almost breaking, and then you add more specialist people. You don't do it the other way around. You don't start hiring specialists here, there, and everywhere. Another that we see is just entering new markets too quickly with massive teams. You know, everything has a flywheel, most of the companies that we invest in. And if your flywheel isn't, if you overhire relative to the rate at which your flywheel is spinning, like metaphorically, it's always a bad idea in terms of capital preservation. You always get yourself in trouble because it's like you just are planting seeds everywhere, but you don't have enough water to water them all when a couple of, you know, when the ones that do sprout up actually sprout up. So yeah, overhiring is probably the number one issue that we're fighting with our founders about, because they see it. They're like, hey, there's a great opportunity here. I want to get a team in here. And also it's, you need to ship product quickly, and speed to market is a winning strategy. So founders often see that I need more capacity, but it's not the case. Like, you invite complexity when you get your team to, I don't know, say more than 10, 15 people. It goes away from just being everybody's kind of telepathically synced and they can work asynchronously and you can just be in a garage or whatever, to you need structure, you need process, and you add a lot of overhead in the company. And a lot of founders end up suddenly like with half their calendar in catching up and keeping investors happy and talking with their C-suite and dealing with people's problems that arise. And they get away from just building good products quickly, which you can do in a smaller team. That's why you often see, you're like, oh, wow, how did these guys bootstrap this massive company with such a small team? I think the answer is they avoided complexity and they avoided overhiring. Bootstrap teams do not have the ability to go and burn a bunch of capital hiring, overhiring. And that's their superpower, that they need to stretch things. And sometimes certain markets encourage more capital efficient behavior, and we love that. So for example, I recently I went to an event in Warsaw where a lot of Ukrainian startups were presenting and kind of sharing their journey. First of all, like the stuff that they've had to deal with in the last year is just phenomenal. Like, hats off to all of them, the environment that they built in. But also capital was hard to come by. You know, it's risky as a VC to put money into founders that are in a potential conflict zone. And so they were doing stuff with budgets that, you know, even in Czech Republic, where I think things are relatively cheap to build, they were just phenomenally stretching things. And that's so cool to start off with that frugal mentality. And then when the VCs come in and we have more of a like grow, you know, we really want to see you grow quickly and scale quickly, and they're already frugal, that's the perfect match. Whereas if you have a kind of founder who's like romantically, I'm in a startup and I'm going to hire heaps of people and have a cool office, and then you give them too much capital because, I don't know, they seem like a fantastic founder, there's a recipe for disaster almost every time, especially in a tough fundraising market like what we have right now.
And would you say to our fellow listeners, from who may be some students or future founders, that they should be more generalist, or more they should more specialize in their studies, in their future fields?
That's a hard one to answer. I was quite generalist in my studies, and now I'm still generalist in my work. I mean, as a VC, you need to be able to do a little bit of everything quite well, and then a couple of things really well. This so-called T-shaped skill set. I think founders are probably a bit the same, because you're facing these decisions daily about things that you've never seen before, and you need to have a bit of intuition to be able to make the right decision, not to be paralyzed consulting all the experts and everything all the time. So you do need to be a bit generalist, but then you need to have this deep understanding of the problem you're solving or the solution that you're, the product you're building. So it's fantastic when we meet technical founders building a technical product. It's a little bit more concerning when we have a generalist founder that wants to build a technical product and doesn't have a strong technical co-founder.
I understand.
That's, yeah. That can be quite a problem, because they don't really understand the complexity of building that technical product. Or they're facing problems like, hey, we wanted to build it quickly, so we outsourced it. Now I'm trying to insource it. And, you know, that in itself is a mountain to climb. So yeah, we do look for, I guess, generalist founders with some very specialist knowledge in the market that they invest in. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, not invest in, that they operate in.
Yeah.
And you have mentioned already the challenges that they, like that investment funds have struggled with, but I want to know yours, your toughest challenge, and how did you address it?
I will say two things. One is, it's all the same thing. It's a journey. So we are on a journey from Telia, and we started off maybe a little bit naively, trying to come at impact capital from almost a concessionary point of view. What I mean by that is there are funds that are trying to return market returns relative to the risk that we take. We take a lot of risk by investing in early stage companies. And it means really that your kind of IRR annually that you're targeting needs to be about 30%, 33%. You know, that's tripling the fund over 10 years. And if you put your money in the S&P 500, you double your money in 10 years. So that's the benchmark for the risk, that we really have to outperform that. We were coming at it initially that there's this, what they call the missing middle in impact, is companies that can't quite return those kind of returns relative to their risk, but they solve a really meaningful problem. And therefore, they need someone who's willing to bridge that gap. So it means that they need someone who is willing to take on that level of risk for maybe a slightly lower expected return. And we wanted to do that in the beginning. And we put together things like mezzanine loans. You know, it's where you have quite favorable repayment terms. Concessionary capital, it's where you perhaps cap your returns in order to be a catalyst for putting a round together. We did just loans that people could pay back, and the interest rate was quite favorable. So these kind of things are not going to return huge money to investors. I think the thing that we were a bit naive about was the capital that we could get our hands on, because in a lot of more Western developed markets, there are funds and foundations that are really looking for concessionary capital providers. We struggled to find it. A lot of our investors, our LPs, were more or less looking for market returns. So we had to evolve to behave slightly, to behave in a different way. So we're no longer looking to be a concessionary fund. And there's a bit of a rebranding exercise that we will have to do around launching the second fund so that people understand that we are targeting VC returns at a fund level, but we are going about it in a slightly different way and looking for different companies. And in the fundraising of this fund, and that's like the second part of this challenge, is it was hard to convey that our thinking and strategy is changing and that our behavior is changing in the second fund. So I would say if you cut our LPs in half, half of them are saying, we really get it, we see what you're doing, and there's returns in that. And we're happy to back it because we see it as a comparable class, asset class to ordinary VC or just an extension of. And you will become part of our portfolio allocation. And we're expecting like good returns from you. We think you can generate good returns and we back you. The other half are saying, I'd maybe give this money to charity, but I really like that you're kind of effective in your charity. I can maybe get some money back from it. And they're kind of, it's a philanthropic pursuit for them. And that's fantastic as well, because we need that money. But I'm not sure that we're quite, we're not a philanthropic, you know, we're not philanthropic capital. We're not effective altruism.
Of course, yeah.
We are now venture capital. And I think it's going to take the second fund for us to show that to people, so that in the third fund, we'll have access to more of the market-driven capital that we were unable to access in this fundraising round for our fund.
Do you feel a downturn that is happening across the VC industry?
Yeah. Where do we start? So, I mean, we've just finished fundraising.
Yeah, I'm interested if this downturn also affected your fundraising. If yes, how? Yeah. And you can elaborate further.
Yeah. So there's horrible lags in venture capital. And actually there's great lags in venture capital. So the great lag is the fact that the market is clearly down right now. Series A onwards is really a tough, a sobering place to be raising money right now. Companies are having bridge rounds where their existing investors are having to double down to support them. A lot of investors are kind of stuck in sunk cost where they just want to keep putting money into it to keep it afloat because they know it's a great company. But I'm not sure that things are going to correct fast enough for that to be capital well deployed. all valuations have essentially gone down one round. So, you know, like a Series D valuation has become the new Series E valuation, and that works its way all the way back, basically to Series A. So Series A valuations, we're seeing heaps of flat rounds, heaps of party rounds. So this is where no one really wants to lead it, and you end up like painfully piecing together a combination of existing investors and investors with lower conviction that just want to be present in your story. And then a lot of companies failing to raise and then not cutting their cash runway fast enough. So they'll raise less, they'll maybe close at less money than they thought they would initially raise, think that another fundraising is around the corner, and it's not there. And unless you correct your cash runway very, very quickly, it's actually quite hard, especially in Europe when you've got 3 months of severance, and you know, it's quite hard to quickly rescale your company down to build out your cash runway. And yeah, it's really tough times for companies from Series A onwards. What I meant from the good lag is that, and this is quite funny, it pre-seed and seed. You're kind of, a lot of the companies now know that they need to raise a bit more money. So they need to get themselves through at least 18 months now. Whereas before you'd leave it a little bit finer. You'd say, let's do 6 months, 12 months. But we can all see that that rounds are taking a lot longer to close, that Series A is not guaranteed. So why not over-dilute a little bit, or, you know, and raise a bit more money now? That's cool. And as a VC, investing at seed, at pre-seed and seed now is a bet that the market will be different in 18 months. So it's quite funny, this lag, that by the time, so seed, pre-seed and seed almost never slows down, because by the time you know that the market is in trouble, it's too late. You've already done your pre-seed and seed, and those companies are facing a really tough Series A now, but it's too late. There's nothing you can do about that. So you just keep investing because you know that the market's going to be better in a couple of years. So there hasn't really been a downturn in pre-seed and seed. If anything, there's been an uptick, because Series A is so tough that some of these funds that still have to deploy capital are thinking, well, let's just go earlier. Like, you know, we don't want our company to run out of money in 6 months. So let's go even earlier in the stages and invest at seed. And then we know that that company won't need to raise again for 18 months. And in 18 months, we think everything's going to be better again. So it's actually pre-seed and seed is fine. The second part of that question was about us as a fund. It's very tough at the moment. Like capital that was available, especially in this region, because we don't have such an appetite for institutional investment into VC. It's not like all these pension funds, you know, your VZP pension fund or something is going out and piling money into venture capital. And if there are larger institutions, all that money is just going to the top tier funds. And there are, you know, a couple, maybe two, three funds in Czech Republic that are really top tier and are attracting that kind of investment. And if you're an up and coming fund or a slightly second tier fund, or maybe your returns are not proven, it is harder to get your hands on capital now. And then for us, like we, being an impact fund, we have even less access to major institutional capital than your regular VC. So we rely a lot on family offices and high net worth individuals. The problem there is that that depends on the feelings and thoughts of one or two successful successful people. And those people's opinions can change. And what we've seen a lot is that really intelligent, great investors have decided, I'm not doing VC. You know, I've just read a lot of bad stuff about it. I'm scared about seeing my current companies that I've invested in go down. So I'm just going to give it a break for a while. Actually, that's counterintuitive, because like I said, the lag is already there, and it's becoming a good vintage to actually put money into VC now, because valuations have come down, and starting a 10-year fund like we are now, I think it puts us in a very good position. But you can understand if you've just had your portfolio from as an LP written down, you know, 90% or whatever, that your fingers are burned and you're not running to put more money into VC right now. So there is a massive downturn, and it has affected us quite sensitively. But, you know, I can say this now because we've closed our fund, or we're just about to close. And even for second closing, we kind of have the pipeline to fill our target. So I feel a little bit like Indiana Jones, where he's going to grab his hat as the door is coming down, that the market is coming into you know, is coming into quite a tough spot. And I do believe it will only get tougher. But I'm really happy that we've raised and closed the fund now and that we can start to deploy into the storm. And therefore, when it changes, we'll be in a lot better position.
And now back to the hotspot of AI. What do you think will be the impact within the VC industry and the impact investment?
It's hard for me to call it now. I mean, we're seeing it. Like, there's some funny things in AI right now. The tools are not quite there. I think the hype is ahead of the tools, a lot like other hype cycles with blockchain or whatever. We're using ChatGPT like everybody else and trying to integrate it into
Could you point out how, for example?
It's really good for market research to understand the market. It's really good to understand who else is doing something in the same space as your company, because this is a question that's not really Googleable, but is pretty good. You get some pretty coherent answers from ChatGPT. I'll maybe come back to that because there's some funny reasons why the tool's not quite there. We use it a lot, like as a small fund, we don't really have a marketing department. We don't have a PR department. So we're leaning on the content abilities of AI a lot. So we're using it as a productivity tool, let's say, at the moment. It hasn't revolutionized our industry as an input tool. It is starting to revolutionize the startups that we invest in. It's just making, you know, it reminds me a lot of cloud computing, that prior to, let's say, early to mid 2000s, as a startup, you'd have to have a server room and, you know, have this like huge capital infrastructure. You'd have to have a systems network engineer. And then all of a sudden cloud computing came along and anybody could just, you know, run their own database online and build a platform on top of that. And this is the reason why you have this, this explosion of Airbnb and Facebook and all these companies that popped up around that time, enabled by cloud computing. I think we're at the same stage now. People thought that was blockchain. It wasn't quite blockchain, but I think we're at a similar step change now, that it's such an enabler for companies to get off the ground in so many fields, in marketing and coding. You know, you can hire more junior coders and they can use that to support their coding. And I mean, it was just yesterday that Google announced their Bard suite and all the integrations that they have. And this just looks phenomenal. I'm so excited to start using that and to see what companies can build on that. Another really interesting thing for startups is we've been looking, because AI has been a buzzword, you know, not just since ChatGPT dropped, definitely, but for the last three years. But what's really interesting is the companies that were avant-garde, or even the organizations that were like avant-garde in AI 2-3 years ago, they have no noticeable advantage right now. Like, the technology is moving faster than a first mover advantage. So it's actually a really cool time right now, because you get the feeling that even if you're a bit slow to build, the stuff is developing so quickly that whatever you built is outdated anyway. So we're entering this world where you just have to be super adaptive. You have to be on top of what the, you know, latest developments are and able to utilize those, because being the master at utilizing the developments from only a year or 6 months ago is becoming like less relevant. So it's just really exciting. But some of the really funny things about the tools not quite being there, like I didn't realize that ChatGPT hallucinates and it just makes stuff up.
Yeah. And then I recently wrote about it. Yeah, yeah.
And you'll like do some market research and you'll say, I'm looking into a company that's doing, I don't know, whatever, recyclable cups in the Czech Republic. Who else is doing this? And it'll give you a list. And then, you know, you almost have to ask ChatGPT, did you just make some of that stuff up? And it'll say, apologies, it seems like I did.
Yeah.
One, because it's not at the moment, it's not connected to, like as we speak. I know this is probably going to be what will come out with the new ChatGPT-4 when it's upgraded with browser access, but it's not accessing the live internet. But it's even more than that. It's just making stuff up. And then you'll ask, like, what's your sources on that? And it will generate a URL, which is like a reference to a known news website with a nonsense suffix on the URL. And then you go to that link and it's just like a 404 error. And it turns out that ChatGPT just made the whole thing up in a hallucination. And the problem is that you cannot rely on it. Like, you then turn around and you say, oh, hey, here's my research and here's the companies that are doing this. you just look like such an idiot when someone's like, hey, this doesn't exist. And that's never been a problem before, to just randomly make things up and then say them to people as if they're fact. But I guess this is a glimpse into the future. And I see my kids saying that. So I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. And a question they always ask now is like, is it real? And it's something that we never asked when we were kids. Like, is it real? Like, they see a video. Is it real? Or a song. Is it real? Yeah. And some text or whatever. And now we have to ask with everything. Is it real? And I guess that's the question of the next, like, 5 years. Is it real? And then I guess the next question is, what is real? But that's getting too philosophical. So we'll stay out of that.
Besides AI, do you see any new fields emerging in the future that could be, let's say, that have the same hype like AI?
For us, it's climate, because the amount of change that's required to reach the goals that a lot of governments and that our planet needs and a lot of governments have committed to is really underestimated. I think I've said this before, so I don't want to repeat myself, but like, we as investors make quite short-term decisions because our life of our fund is only 5 years for the investment period, 10 years for the total life of fund. So we look at things that make a splash in the next 5 years, and it makes it quite hard to truly see the magnitude of change. And we only start to see it in kind of proxy ways. So for example, a lot of really great founders that could go and build, I don't know, some crypto fintech startup, they're choosing to apply themselves in the field of climate. So that's fantastic. And then you have, like, you know, a lot of people, they work for Goldman Sachs for a year or BCG or whatever, and then they're like, I want to do something else. And it used to be like, I'll go in a startup, and that startup was maybe also a fintech startup. Now they're saying, like, I want to work in climate. So all this incredible talent is coming in to the area. So it's becoming like the class of teams that we're seeing solving these problems is just awesome. And then from the other side, the money and focus that's coming in from big corporates and governments, because ultimately a lot of these markets that we all invest in, as much as we don't want to say that, they're regulatorily driven. You know, they're driven way downstream by governments and by the taste of corporations. For example, electric cars. Like, no one would, it's not consumers that drove electric cars. It's that, like, consumers didn't really touch them until they became better and comparable cost or cheaper than regular cars. And it wasn't about consumer taste, really. It was about governments, especially Californian government, coming in and just subsidizing, you know, the hell out of it and enabling people like Tesla to build incredible cars. And now everybody's doing it because all the governments are subsidizing it. So it's really like the governments that saved the electric car, plus Elon, I guess, but... different. I promise not to talk about him in any podcast. So yeah. So this is happening across the board now. There's just so much money, you know, Green New Deal and the regulation that's coming in, the requirements, the corporate focus on it, and also the consumer expectation that that climate is, I think, the place to be deploying capital. I really honestly believe it's the best returns and most exciting opportunity for the next 10 years. And things like AI, is a technology. It's going to be present in climate and in kind of whatever, fintech or whatever. We will harness those tools, but like, investing in a technology for technology's sake is quite a boring thing to do. So it's cool that now tools exist for founders to start even better companies and get a, you know, and grow even faster. But I think really climate is the area that's most exciting for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're coming kind of to an end. And I felt really fascinated by your knowledge and what you have shared with us. So I would like to ask if you have any recommendations, like books, like LinkedIn profiles, people to follow, podcasts for our audience in case if they want to deep into the VC industry.
Yeah, do you mean like VC or impact or...
Both.
Okay.
Both VC. Yeah.
So if you're looking to get into VC, let's say, then the staple Bible is a book called Venture Deals. And it just has the most boring name. And it even has a boring premise, which is it goes through like a term sheet and looks at all the terms. And every VC that you talk to will like deny that it's an interesting book. They're lying. It's like the Bible for understanding venture capital. So even as a founder, I recommend to read it because you will be negotiating with VC investors, and you need to understand the implication of all these terms. And And, you know, the term sheet is our way of structuring and communicating with founders around commercial terms. So it's completely, like, it is the essence of our business. So if you understand the term sheet, you really understand venture capital. If you are getting more senior into venture capital, or you want to really understand, like, what is venture capital and how it works, there's a couple of really interesting books, which, again, like, are boring staple diets, but I guess your listeners are university students and are maybe picking this up for the first time. So one is called The Power Law, and that's like a really interesting kind of history of venture capital. And then another is called Secrets of Sand Hill Road. And I think if every venture capital partner was to read Power Law and Secrets of Sand Hill Road, it would be easier conversations between VCs. That it goes through really the history of what is VC, why are we doing it, what's the difference between private equity, and a lot of success stories and what makes companies tick in these Power Law distributions like venture capital funds have. Around climate, so again, like basic easy books to access, like Bill Gates wrote this fantastic book, I think it's called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. And I really like that because it's like solution oriented. It's not just a doom and gloom book. A lot of the books from the 2000s were doom and gloom, and now it's more solution oriented. Similarly, and I've said this before, there's a book called Speed and Scale by John Doerr from Kleiner Perkins. And that's also like very investor friendly, climate thesis focused. Then, for all VCs, if any VCs are listening to this and they're doing climate investment and they want to see a really good investment thesis, look at Y Combinator's request for startups. They released this at, I think it was December last year, and it's basically asking founders, please solve these problems. And I couldn't have said it better myself. It's such a fantastic, and then avoid doing these things because it's a waste of your time. So check that out. It's like an hour long read. It's like the longest web page you could ever read, but it's really an hour well spent.
One last two questions before we wrap these things up. I usually ask this at the end to my host. What are you currently watching or streaming on Netflix or other platforms?
I actually don't watch that much Netflix. I don't really have the time, like with the kids and, you know. But let's say maybe the last interesting thing that I watched that is noteworthy was Obama's Our National Parks. Have you seen that?
Not yet.
He's like the new David Attenborough.
Really?
I mean, not only is his voice melodic to listen to, but he just does a fantastic job of getting into like the essence of what's important about these national parks. And it's really inspiring. Like it makes you want to just pack up and go and visit these places. And it also addresses, you know, the hippie side of let's look after this and let's do the things that we need to do to protect our planet. So that's cool. If you haven't checked it out, definitely check it out. And I hope that Obama will make more of these.
And last question, what is your favorite drink and why?
Yeah, so I'm pretty simple in that sense that I love whiskey and I have a whiskey club that I go to once a month with some mates. And so for me,
in Prague?
Yeah, here in Prague, a little place called Marpec. It's really a funny place. Like they've pulled the walls out of a Scottish bar, imported them here and reassembled it. So you have the feeling that you're in Scotland. The drinks are suspiciously low priced and it's just a fantastic place to hang out. And so for me, it's just a straight whiskey and it's more about trying different flavors and trying to, you know, enjoy the experience of tasting different whiskeys.
Okay, I need to try and go there.
Absolutely.
Andy, I appreciate sharing all this knowledge with us, with our listeners. I think everybody who is listening to this podcast will definitely learn something from it, and it will give them edge to learn more about it in the future. It was a pleasure. Maybe you want to leave some last-minute notes to listeners?
No, thank you. I mean, it's fantastic to be here, and I'm happy to do something that's student-oriented because it's actually how I met my wife. I studied just around the corner from where we're recording this at the local economics university just for one semester. So it's fun to be back in the neighborhood and to think that students that are attending there might be listening to this. So thank you, guys. I love what you're doing.
Andy, I thank you. And I also want to thank you, listeners. Thank you for listening to my conversation and Omar's conversation with Andy till the end. Do not forget to give us a review and follow us on other social medias. If you want to reach us directly, you can do so via email provided in the footnotes. Till next time.
Thank you.